Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Chewell versus National Action Financial. Mr. Phillips?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm David Phillips. I represent Ms. Calvine Chewell, the plaintiff appellant here. The issue before this Court is a little bit different than the issue it confronted in Miller versus McCalla. This is a provision under Section 1692G of the FDCPA, which is a provision that this Court's visited twice recently and has visited many times as do other provisions of 1692G. Under 1692G of the Fair Debt Act, debt collectors are required to do several things. They're required to effectively communicate to consumers that they have a right to dispute the debt within 30 days. And this Court's looked at that 30-day provision in several cases, Avila versus Rubin, Bartlett versus Heibel, and Chauncey versus JDR. And in the 30-day provision, this Court said it's not enough to just give the notice. You have to effectively give the notice. You can't put other things in there that cause confusion or contradict that 30-day provision. The provision we're talking about today is under 1692G, debt collectors are also required to state the amount of the debt. Here, the debt collector's letter states an amount for the debt, but then goes on to say, to obtain your most current balance information, please call 1-800.
What can they do? Because interest keeps running every day, so
sure,
what do you want them to do?
In this case, they could have done what you had suggested in the panel you were on in Miller McHale with the Safe Harbor letter, which is if they want to try to collect more interest, they say this is the amount of the debt as of this date because of interest or late charges or whatnot. When the day you pay, you may owe more. So call us if you want to know what the more amount is. But here,
is that substantially different from what they did?
I think it is substantially different because there isn't that transitional phrase explaining the difference. Just as in Bartlett versus Heibel, where the debt collector wanted to say, pay us in 7 days or we may sue you, the consumer was left with, what do? Do I have 7 days or do I have the 30 days to dispute it? And there the transitional phraseology that was suggested by a panel that you were on, Your Honor, was, although we may sue you in this period, you still have the right to dispute the debt within 30 days. And I think that's where the problem is in this collection letter. It doesn't have that transitional phrase which explains this is actually the amount we want. Here, one just left to scratch their head. Is this the current balance or isn't it? Is this the amount we're trying to collect or isn't it?
It does suggest that you might make a phone call. And it does use the phrase current balance as opposed to balance. I mean, we do have two different phrases, do we not, Mr. Phillips?
Yes, you do, Your Honor. You have two different phrases, and that's the problem because there's no explanation of how those two phrases fit together.
Yeah, but it tells you how you can make a phone call, right?
Sure, you could make a phone call, which is exactly what the court Miller-McCalla said.
But there was just a phone number. There wasn't a dollar amount there.
Well, there was a dollar amount, but it may not have been the total dollar amount because they may also have wanted in Miller-McCalla to collect late fees and additional charges and other charges. It stated an amount. Miller-McCalla stated an amount, just like in Veach versus Sheik, another 1692 GA1 case where there was an amount stated. But then they tried to add some other information onto that, and they didn't explain how those amounts fit together. And in Veach versus Sheik, this circuit held, it's not enough that you got it right in one place. Here, they got it right in one place. But the other place, we're left to guess. What is the amount they're trying to get? They could have just said, this is the amount you owe as of the date of this letter. That would have been a simple fix.
Well, they also didn't give the source, did they? They didn't say what might affect the increase, why there might be an increase.
In this letter, they don't say what would affect an increase. In the other letters, they did say what might affect an increase.
If we use the unsophisticated measure, which we're told we should use, the unsophisticated creditor, the unsophisticated creditor may not know the reason why there would be a difference between the balance and the current balance.
That's correct. The unsophisticated consumer may not know what the difference is between the current balance, stated balance, but if they would have
too much information here, Mr. Phillips, right?
I think so.
Just you ought to just, if they want the 367.42, just ask for that and not even mention the current balance, right?
I think so. If they do want to
less information is better.
In this particular case, I think it is, unless there's an explanation as to why we may want more. And frequently that happens.
Well, Counselor, did they want the 367 or did they want the current balance? What did they want?
We don't know. There's no evidence in the record as to what they wanted. All we have is an affidavit saying this is the amount that we got from the creditor, and that's it.
Have we ever approved a letter under this section where the difference between the reasons for the difference between the current balance and the balance stated wasn't set forth in the letter?
You haven't addressed that, Your Honor. You've only addressed it in those two cases, Miller-McKella, where they stated a principal amount and then they said we may want X, Y, and Z in addition, and then Beach versus Cheeks, where they did set forth the total amount due, but then they tried to add other things on that may not.
So the importance of this case then is that it will determine whether or not the letter needs to explain to the unsophisticated creditor the difference between the balance stated and his current balance.
I think that's one of the important issues, and also the
issue. Has any other circuit addressed that issue?
No, Your Honor. This is the only circuit that has really addressed the issue. It's the leading circuit on the 1692 GA1.
And we haven't addressed this particular question.
Not this particular question. And
so this is a matter of first impression in the country, then?
I think so, Your Honor. And I think the other issue that is of first impression is the district court finding the letter confusing, said it did a poor job of communicating to the unsophisticated consumer, said, well, despite that, you need survey evidence. Picking up on some other decisions by this court in Walker versus National Recover.
But now, one of the problems in Miller referred to unpaid principal balance and made clear that it wanted more. In this case, if your client had remitted the $367.42 in the envelope that was provided, would she in fact have been billed for more?
We have no idea, Your Honor. There's
but if she would, then there's no problem, right?
If she wasn't going to be billed for more?
In other words, one way to read this is that pay us the $367.42 in the envelope we've given you, and that's fine, and that's it. Now, if you don't pay, you know, or if you have other debts with us, you know, then you get a current balance. Now, if that were true, that she could discharge the debt by paying the $367.42, then there wouldn't be a problem.
I would respectfully disagree with that. I think that points out exactly the problem, Your Honor, which is that's one way you could read it. Another way you could read it is we want more. And regardless of what the creditor was actually trying to get, if you leave the consumer scratching their head as to if I pay this $360, am I done? Or do they want more? That's the essential problem. You're left scratching your head if you're the consumer. And you're not the unsophisticated consumer, Judge. None of us in this courtroom are. I think we're probably a far sight more sophisticated man. If we're sitting here scratching our head, like the district court did, like we're doing here talking today, what chance does the unsophisticated consumer have, which is, as this court's noted, is pretty low to the bottom barrel of sophistication meter. The reasonable person...
Yeah, Ms. Phillips, in this case, would we, I don't know if the record reflects this figure of 367.42, would it have ever, in any prior communication billing, have been sent as a specific number to the plaintiff?
The record doesn't reflect that, Your Honor. I'm sure at some point she got credit card statements from Capital One Services, but that's another thing that's the problem with consumers, which is, by the time it gets turned over from the creditor, the bill collector, there usually is a disconnect period there, several months, where you may not know what the balance is.
Well, you know the dates that are on the bill, and you know whether you made purchases post the dates, don't you?
The dates on the collection bill? Or
the dates on the statement.
Oh,
the
sure.
They run from day one to whatever, day
sure.
21, so you know that expenses occurred post that, or you know if you're using the card, I guess is what I'm saying.
Sure, but what I'm saying is the disconnect isn't from you using the card to you got the statement to the collector. The disconnect is between your last statement from the creditor and when they finally turn it over to the bill collector. There's a lag there. It's not immediate, and by that time, in my experience, consumers aren't quite sure what the amount is, which is the exact reason why Congress put this provision in.
Well, they would know it wouldn't be less than that last statement unless they had made a payment, right?
Sure, that's correct. That's correct. And unless Your Honors have any further questions, I'll say whatever time I have left.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Phillips.
Thank you.
Mr. Pedersen?
May it please the court.
Pedersen, why do you put that second line in there to obtain your most current balance information? If you're looking for 367.42, why are you putting in something else in there?
The debt in question is a credit card account. The agreement allows the creditor to add interest charges, and the language in question puts the consumer on notice that interest may be accruing
after the letter is mailed.
It doesn't say that, does it? No. Why didn't you use the language in our opinion?
I couldn't answer that question, Your Honor. I've not addressed that with.
Then you wouldn't have this lawsuit.
The letter is not identical to the safe harbor approved in Miller, but nonetheless.
Well, it's not at all similar.
I believe it constitutes a reasonable facsimile of that letter, but in any event, it certainly complies with 1692G as a matter of law.
Well, Mr. Pedersen, do you want the 367 or do you want the current balance? What did you want from this person?
What the statute required as of the...
No, what did you want from this person? What did you want from this person?
My instinct, Your Honor, is that as of the date on the letter...
Your instinct? Come on now.
I would surmise.
Don't surmise. It's your client. What did your client want from her? You know, if you don't know, say you don't know.
Well, I've not addressed that
question
directly. So I don't know, but...
You don't know. Well, forget it.
I would surmise, though, from the request in the letter...
I don't think your surmise is worth anything.
What I would submit to the court is that 1692G requires the initial letter to state the amount of the debt, including interest and other charges, as of the date the initial letter is mailed.
Ridiculous. You don't know what this letter is demanding. How do you expect Chewy to know?
Well, Your Honor, the letter does request the consumer to remit
you
payment
don't know
of
the what the com- You don't know whether she can discharge her debt by paying $367.42 or not.
I have no reason to believe that payment would
you
not discharge
the debt. You have no idea
the
what the answer is.
I would submit, Your Honor, respectfully, that the request in the letter for payment of the reported balance indicates that is the amount that is sought for collection. Now, who knows if months pass in which the debt was not paid, additional interest might have been charged by the creditor, in which case NAFS would have been required to request payment.
Well, are you saying that if she, within some reasonable time, whether that is, sent you the $367.42, that would be the end of it. You wouldn't bill her further on this debt. Is that what you're saying?
That is what I would answer based on the request in the letter for payment of the reported balance in the cash.
But you don't know as a matter of fact. There's no affidavit in the record or anything that indicates that is your client's position.
That's correct, but importantly, the affidavit...
Why don't you put in some evidence? So we know what this means.
The reason, Your Honor, is that we believe it's not material, not dispositive as to whether the letter complies with 1692G under the Miller
decision.
Well,
if it's confusing, that's material.
The letter isn't confusing, though.
Well, it is, because you don't even know what it means. You have a surmise, but you don't actually know what it means.
No, I do know what the letter means, and it's apparent.
No, you don't know whether they're asking for $367.42 or $367 plus, you know, interest and who knows what.
No, the letter requests specifically payment of the balance reported, and I know that the letter discloses the information required by Miller. Miller requires a statement of the amount owed on the date the letter is mailed, including all applicable charges. The evidence submitted in this case establishes that the collection letter, in fact, did state the amount owed as of the date on the letter. Nothing in the letter indicates that the reported balance included charges that were not owed on the date of the letter or omitted charges that were owed. So the letter on its face complies with the statement of the debt requirement as it was interpreted in the Miller decision. In addition, there are no references to other dates in the letter which would lead a consumer to believe that the reported balance applied to a date other than the date on the letter. So for that reason, the letter does comply. It is not confusing. It sets out the information mandated by 1692G as it was interpreted in Miller. Miller does not, and 1692G does not, require a statement of the amount the collector is seeking to collect as of the date the letter is received or as of any future date. All it requires is how much is owed on the date you're mailing the letter. That's the best the debt collector can do. The court addressed the question of whether the debt collector could state the amount that was actually owed on dates subsequent to mailing the letter.
Why is the debt collector so concerned about current balance? Isn't that you haven't been engaged yet to collect that, I assume, at the date of sending out the 367.42 number. Why is the National Action concerned with the current balance? I mean, you may be engaged, I suspect, at some point if the recount remains delinquent.
National Action is committed to complying with the FDCPA, so it's concerned about the current balance because it has to report that amount in the initial letter. The reason National Action would refer to the possibility of an updated, most current balance is the creditor may be adding interest charges to the debt subsequent to the mailing of the initial letter. When National Action mails the initial letter, it accesses a database owned by the creditor and pulls the balance information out of that database and plugs it into the letter.
But are you engaged to do that, pass that information on? Or are you engaged to collect the 367.42?
National Action is engaged to collect that amount. National Action is engaged to collect the amount reported in the creditor's database.
So your position is that National Action is just being helpful in letting the creditor know there's another financial arrangement still in pending? Or?
The language puts the consumer on notice that the balance might increase. If the payment is received many months later, it might be inadequate, or it might be adequate, but the creditor has the liberty under the credit card agreement to add charges after the initial letter is mailed when the balance is at 367.42.
You talk about months, but it could be minutes, right?
I suppose that's correct because interest can be accruing on a daily basis. But the court's analysis does not need to delve into the minutiae of the accrual of interest because what's required under the statute is a statement of the amount owed on the date the letter is mailed. And the evidence here establishes that the collection letter did in fact report that amount. Nothing in the letter indicated that the reported balance is incorrect. The decisions which have invalidated collection letters under 1692G dealt with language in a letter that expressly indicated that the reported balance was either incomplete, as in Miller, or that the reported balance included charges which were not currently due, as in Veach. In Miller, the letter contained a disclaimer that the reported balance did not include most recent late charges, most recent interest charges, and other charges made for the preservation of the creditor's collateral. So the letter expressly stated that we have not given you a complete statement of the debt. This case is completely different. Nothing in the letter suggests that the reported balance is incomplete. Similarly, in the Veach decision, the letter ran afoul of the statute because it included statutory penalties and attorney's fees, which were not due on the date the letter was mailed and could become due in the future only if a court of law held the consumer liable for those additional charges. The collection letter violated the statute because it arrogated to the collector the power to hold the debtor liable for those additional charges.
It's that second paragraph that hurts you. If you left that out, your argument would be quite persuasive.
Well, on the subject, Your Honor, of the reference to the 1-800 number, it's worthwhile to note that the Miller v. McCalla decision approved a safe harbor letter that contained a 1-800 number. So the
and that's true, but that's because you had we're discussing a situation where interest is accruing, and what the debt collector wants is the principal as of the date of the letter plus subsequently accruing interest. Now you say all you want is the 367.42, and if there's any interest because of late payment or something, that's something between the actual, you know, credit card company and Chewy.
But that's correct, Your Honor.
But Chewy could be confused and wonder whether you wanted that balance or whether you wanted her to call up and find some current balance.
In the event that there was any confusion created by the disclosure of the amount due, it was incumbent on the plaintiff under this court's precedent in Johnson and Walker to put forward empirical data.
Like what? What would that consist of?
In the form of a survey, in the form of
I don't think these plaintiffs... Well, is this a class action?
It is a putative class action, Your Honor. The summary judgment motion was decided before class certification. The 1692G creates an anti-confusion norm. The only way to establish, in the absence of a direct contradiction of the required statutory disclosures, that the letter violated the anti-confusion norm is to show, either in a survey or in a reality test, that the letter actually misled.
What's a reality test?
A reality test would be, in some way, gauging the responses of the actual consumers who received the letter in question, and measuring whether they were able to understand that the letter reported the amount they owed as of the date on the letter. But the plaintiff in this case didn't put forward a reality check. Pardon me?
We know that.
Or survey data, and she therefore failed to meet her burden of proof under the Johnson and Walker decisions. And for that reason, even if the court finds that the letter is potentially confusing, we would submit that the trial court's decision should be upheld. Thank you.
Mr. Phillips? Mr. Phillips, in Bartlett and Heibel in 1997, we said the issue of confusion is for the district court. So are we working here under clear error?
Your Honor, I think that we're not really on this one, because the judge made a statement of law that's incorrect. She thought that based on Walker and Marshall Mosby, a couple subsequent cases, that you had to have survey. And we would submit that Walker and Marshall Mosby teach that you could have a survey if you wanted. In the Avila case, this court specifically rejected the contention that you had to have a survey to win.
Look, how do you deal with Mr. Peterson's argument that all his client was hired to collect was the 367.42. The other stuff, late interest charges, what have you, that's a separate potential dispute between the credit card company and your client.
I have no idea what that means.
What do you mean with that? If he was hired just to collect 367.42, then...
Where does it say that in the collection letter? Where does it say that in the record? It doesn't. And the fact that
were hired to collect, then if they left out this second paragraph, to obtain your most current balance information, you wouldn't have any quarrel.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But because we're left with guessing, and so I would just one final point. I disagree with counsel that it's enough that you state the amount of the debt, and you got that right. You have to effectively state the amount of the debt. You have to effectively communicate the 30-day validation notice. That's what this court has said in Veach versus Sheep and in all the cases about the 30-day validation period. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. The case is taken under advisement.